It's good to be here this morning. It's good to celebrate what the Lord is doing in our military. Revival going on among soldiers. It's good to partner with our military chaplains in getting these military Bible 6 out into their hands. Thank you for being part of that last year. I hope that we can match that this year. It's also moving, I think, to imagine ourselves, you know, cinematography is able to do so much to recreate that scene. I hope that when you watch that, you can put yourself there, feel some of the feelings that young Mary would have felt, Joseph, the shepherds in the field that night, the delivery in the manger or in the stable, and then Jesus, the baby, there in the manger. It is definitely a moving time of year, is it not? It's a time to rejoice, time to celebrate. My name is Brian Smith. I'm the lead pastor here at Wildwood. It's good for you to be here. I'm thankful that you're here with us. If it's your first time visiting with us, I'd ask you to do us a favor and fill out the guest check-in card or the guest connection card in your bulletin and take that to our welcome desk where we have a little gift for you. If it's not your first time visiting with us, we'd ask you to check in so that we have record of your attendance today. Christmas is synonymous with gifts, at least in my house. What is it like in your house? Pretty sure that most of us, our kids, know at Christmas time they're going to get some gifts under the tree. And there's nothing wrong with giving gifts at Christmas, nothing wrong with us shopping and being generous, because the reality is that this season is a season that is marked by generosity. It's a time for us to focus on and to celebrate God's abundant generosity. And so gift giving is just a fun way for parents to be part of that generosity each year. But the reality is that we all know that the greatest gift given at Christmas doesn't come wrapped in a box. We know that the greatest gift given at Christmas comes in the person of Jesus. This season, we're going to explore this greatest gift. And in many ways, this gift given really was outside the box. And we're going to begin with the fact that Jesus came in the form of a baby, a helpless baby. Now, unless you've just recently moved here from a non-Western world, then the baby Jesus in the manger is totally familiar to you. So familiar to you that you don't give it any cerebral activity. It doesn't cause you to reflect and wonder and think and wrestle with that fact. It's as normal to you as Christmas lights and Christmas trees and gifts under the tree. But I want to stop and invite you for a minute to think and give some reflection to the greatest, one of the most significant statements ever spoken. In Luke chapter 1, verse 35, the angel tells Mary, "Therefore, the child to be born will be called holy, the Son of God." The child to be born will be called holy, the Son of God. I love how the Jesus Storybook Bible puts this. If you don't have a Jesus Storybook Bible and you have kids or grandkids, you really ought to get one, because it captures the majesty of this moment in a way that is so simple that even a child can understand. And yet it leaves adults in wonder and awe. It says, "The God who flung planets into space and kept them whirling around and around, the God who made the universe with just a word, the one who could do anything at all, was making himself small and coming down as a baby." Of all the ways that God could have worked salvation, why this way? Why not a king? Why not a warrior? Why not a superhero? That's how my mind works. If I'm going to save the world, I want to send a king or a warrior or a superhero to rescue the world. And God sent a baby. Why a baby? Today we're going to look at a few reasons that help us understand why Jesus, the Son of God, was born. Why he was sent to us in the form of a human baby. And first of all, he came to reveal perfectly who God is. If you look around today, you listen to much talk radio or TV, or you read many articles online, one thing is true. People have opinions about just about everything, and they're not afraid to share it. People have lots of opinions, especially about God, about what he's like, about what he expects, about what he offers. But can we really know what God is like? I mean, can we really, as people, truly know what God is like? Adam and Eve had a perfect knowledge of God in the Garden of Eden, but because they chose to disobey God and chose instead to live life their way, they exchanged their intimacy with God for isolation from him. So how can man really know what God is like? God could have, and in fact did, send messengers to speak on his behalf and to represent him and to speak for him and to tell us what he's like. But the trouble is that man is really bad at representing what God is like and who he is. We botch it. If the Old Testament reveals anything, it reveals how broken man is. Fathers like Abraham are broken. Mothers like Sarah are broken. Judges are broken. Kings and priests and prophets, all broken. Now, of course, God used them to do important and significant things, but none of them could adequately reveal who God is, what he wants for us, what he expects, and what he offers to mend our brokenness. So God came himself, because who better to express his heart than himself? If we're going to know who God is, then he has to reveal himself, and so he did, through the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the perfect revelation of God to the world. Or as Hebrews 1:3 says, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. What do we mean here by radiance of the glory of God? Well, man had thus far been kept from looking upon the glory of God. Moses had been hidden in a cave when he was there on Mount Sinai. He wants to see God, and he begs God to show him. And God says, you can't look upon my glory and live. So I'm going to put you in a rock, in the cleft of a rock in a cave, and I'm going to put my hand over the opening so that you can't look upon me until I have passed by. And then he lifts his hand and allows Moses to see the trail of glory. The glory of God is his holy, eternal, self-existent, unapproachable light. It's the essence of who he is. But in Jesus, who is the radiance of the glory of God, we have now an approachable light. It says that he's the exact imprint, like a stamp or a seal, which perfectly translates. Translates what? His nature, the substance of God, the character of God. Jesus came to show man exactly what God is like. We can know for sure what God is like because Jesus is the exact imprint of his nature. He's of the same substance, the same character, and therefore perfectly reveals God's nature. We know who God is because we know who Jesus is. Jesus was so confident that this is true that he made some really audacious claims about himself. Claims that if they are not absolutely true, they must be absolutely and outrightly rejected. C.S. Lewis said that Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord. If what he says about himself, the claims he makes about himself, are not true, then he must be rejected. He can't be a moral teacher, a moral man, a good man in any way unless he's Lord. He makes some claims like the one found in John 14:9. He says, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. He's responding in that passage to Philip, who says, show us what God is like. Show us the Father. It'll be enough. Help us understand who God is and what he's like. And Jesus says, if you've seen me, if you know what I'm like, then you know what God is like. That's an audacious claim. He went on to describe how the Father dwelt in him, how the Father speaks through him and works through him. They were so unified and so identical and so connected that he could say, if you have seen me, if you know what I'm like, then you know exactly what God the Father is like. If you want to understand God the Father, look to Jesus. If you want to understand God's nature, his essence, his substance, his priorities, his heart, then look to Jesus. He's the exact imprint of his nature. One of the greatest misperceptions about God is that he's angry, that he's ready to squash us like the bugs that we are. Is that really what God is like? Is God really an angry God waiting to squash us? If he were, why hasn't he yet? And further, and maybe more importantly, why would he send a rescuer to save us if he were just angry and wanted to squash us? It's because he loves us, and God sent proof, and Jesus is the proof of his love. As Romans 5:8 says, but God shows his love for us, or demonstrates his love for us, or proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We don't have to guess about how God feels about us. We don't have to wonder and speculate and take people's opinions. We don't have to guess what God feels about us. We know what he feels. Why? Because actions speak louder than words. And even though God said he loved us throughout his word, he proved it by sending his own son to die for us. Not after we had made ourselves lovable, but while we were still sinners, before we could clean ourselves up. God sent his own son to show us the great lengths that he would go to in order to have relationship with us. And not because he had to, but because he wanted to. So this sort of helps us see why God would send his own son, but why did he need to come as a baby? Couldn't Jesus have come as a 30-year-old man? Couldn't he have just shown up, done his thing, and gone back home? Why not a warrior? Why not a king? Why not even a man? You ever watch superhero movies? I watch some superhero movies, and I'm not a buff, and so I don't need you to email me back and say, oh, but you forgot about this edition of this show and this comic book and things like this. A little bit out of my league in this area, but I think that it translates here. Most mainline superhero movies began with an ordinary Joe, just like you and me, that somehow becomes this superhero and is put on this mission and rescues the world. And why is it that, or in the case of Superman, you know, Superman comes from some other galaxy and comes to the earth with supernatural powers, but even Superman takes on this persona of Clark Kent, this ordinary working guy. Why do the people that write these stories write them this way? I think it's because the audience wants to be able to relate to the superhero, wants to be able to relate and connect in a meaningful way. This person that has come to rescue the world is just like me. I think there's this profound innate drive within us to connect to our rescuer in a meaningful way. And I think that's why Jesus was sent in the form of a baby, rather than a king or a warrior or a superhero, so that we could relate authentically. He came to experience the human condition as a human, not just to walk among us, not to just be here for a second and then get out of here, but to actually be part of our experience, to experience life exactly the way you and I do, from birth to death and everything in between. Jesus is able to relate authentically to us. Think about this for a second. For 30 of his 33 years, Jesus was ordinary. Jesus was normal. Jesus was just a carpenter's son. In Luke chapter 4, verses 16 through 22, Jesus goes back to his hometown of Nazareth. The people that grew up with him, the people that knew who he was. And he goes into the temple and he's reading from the scroll of Isaiah and he reads the prophecy of the Messiah and he stands in front of these people, his hometown friends, and he says, "Today in your hearing, this prophecy is being fulfilled." In other words, Isaiah was speaking about me. And all the people that knew him responded, "Isn't that Joseph's son?" In other words, "Bro, you feeling okay today? Like, we know you. We know who you are. We know where you came from. We've been around you for 30 years. What is remarkable about your life is how unremarkable it is. How ordinary, how normal it is. Why spend 90% of your time on earth doing something that everybody else can do?" I mean, I think we need to wrestle with this and grapple with this because Jesus, who enjoyed everything that God enjoys in heaven for all of eternity, gave that up for 30 years to do nothing, to be a baby and an infant and a toddler and a teenager and a young man. And then finally, at 30 years of age, 30 years of being separated from his father on earth, he finally begins his ministry and does that for 3 years. Why does he go to those lengths? Could he not have just simply come as a 30-year-old and called his disciples and began his teaching ministry and done the miracles and went to the cross and gotten back to heaven? He could have done that. So why spend 30 years of a 33-year life just doing nothing? I think he did that so that he could relate to you and I, so that he could know exactly what you and I go through. That when you say, "This is painful, this is difficult," Jesus can say, "I know. I've been there." Hebrews 4, 14 through 16 lays this out and offers a great assurance for us. It says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Our high priest, as this passage calls Jesus, is able to relate to us completely in every way. It says that he was tempted in every respect as we are. He knows what life is like. Why? Because he lived it for 30 years. He knows how to relate to us completely. And we need in a priest or a pastor or a shepherd someone that we can go to that will be able to say to us, "I feel your pain. I know what you're experiencing. I've walked in your shoes." And look, having that common experience creates this opportunity that might not otherwise be there. An opportunity for us to approach the throne of grace with confidence and receive grace and mercy. It says, "Let us then, in light of Jesus' experience as a human being tempted in every way, yet without sin, in light of this, let us then go to Jesus in confidence, knowing that when we come before him with our trials and our temptations and our hardships and our difficulties, we will not get condescension, we will not get judgment, but we will get what? Grace and mercy in our time of need." Jesus knows our struggles. He knows the temptations that we face, and he also knows how to resist. And he invites us to come to him as someone who can relate to our struggles. The Bible teaches that Jesus knew temptation, Mark 1:13, knew poverty, Matthew 8:20, knew frustration, John 2:15 and 16, knew weariness, John 4:6, knew disappointment, Luke 13:34, He knew rejection, John 6:66. He knew sorrow, Matthew 26:38. He knew ridicule, Mark 15:19. Jesus knew loneliness, Matthew 27:46. And the shortest verse in the Bible, John 11:35, he wept. Jesus knew loss. Jesus came as a baby so that he could reveal to us who God is perfectly, being the exact imprint of his nature. If we know Jesus, we know God. We don't have to guess what God is like because we see Jesus. And whatever Jesus is like, God is like. He came to reveal perfectly who God is. And he came as a baby so that he could relate to us authentically, to our human experience, in every possible way. There's one more reason that we're going to consider today, because just knowing who God is and just having Jesus having sympathy for us doesn't really solve our greatest problem. If the story stopped there, it would just mean that we know why God separated himself from us. He's holy and we're not. And that Jesus feels bad for us. So that doesn't really sound like a gift. We're separated because God is holy. Jesus feels bad about that. Doesn't really solve our problem just yet. But that's not where the story stops. Thankfully, there's one more reason, which is that Jesus came to reconcile effectually. Now, we don't use that word effectually very often, but I think that it's the right word to use. Reconcile is defined by the Oxford Concise English Dictionary as to restore friendly relations between two people. And Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines effectually as producing or able to produce a desired effect. And so what this means, he came to reconcile effectually, is that Jesus achieves the purpose of restoring friendly relations between you and God. He gets the job done. Man's greatest problem is not that life is hard, but that in our sin, we're unable to reconcile ourselves to God. We're cut off from relationship with him. We can't come into his presence because he's holy and we're not. You know that and I know that. But that doesn't stop people from trying in their own power to reconcile themselves to God. And we call trying to reconcile yourself to God religion. We call it trying to earn your way to heaven. And I would argue that that is ineffectual reconciliation. It is incapable, unable to achieve its desired end. The Bible makes it clear that none of us is good enough to reconcile ourselves. Romans 3 says, no one is good, not even one. Ephesians 2 says that we're dead in sin. And what do dead people do? They stay dead. So we sometimes make these ineffectual attempts to reconcile ourselves to God, saying things like, God, if you'll get me out of hell, or if you'll get me out of this situation, if you'll do this for me, then I'll never do this again. So there's this moralistic teaching. God, if you'll take your judgment away, if you'll take hell away, then I'll just stop doing these things and I'll live as a good person, or I'll go to church, or I'll give money to charity, or I'll read the Bible. Well, just like the United States doesn't negotiate with terrorists, God doesn't negotiate with dead religious people. It just doesn't happen. There's only one way to be reconciled to God, the person of Jesus Christ. Colossians 1, 19 and 22 says, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds. Boy, the Bible doesn't speak very highly of us, does it? You who were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. It says, for the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. How is it that the fullness of God was pleased to dwell in Jesus? It's the hypostatic union. Jesus was fully God and fully man and perfectly come together. It says, through him, as opposed to through adherence to rules, we are reconciled not through religion, not through doing the right things, not through adherence to rules and regulations, but rather we are reconciled through him. That is how friendly relations between us and God are restored. That is effectual reconciliation. It says, by the blood of his cross, Jesus didn't just wish away your sin. His being born as a baby was not enough to take away your sin. He didn't wish it away. They didn't sweep it under the rug, but rather he paid the penalty on the cross. God sent his own son to us as a human baby to stand in your place, to make peace between you and God, and to present you holy and blameless before him. That's a pretty amazing gift, if you ask me. I'm pretty sure my kids didn't find that on Amazon as they were doing our Christmas shopping for themselves. But the reality is that like all other gifts, this gift of reconciliation is given, not forced upon you. God has made a way for us to be reconciled to him, the gift of his son, Jesus. And so I stand with the Apostle Paul, who said in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 18 through 21, we implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. As the worship team returns, we'll close with just a few final thoughts. This season, as you turn your mind to Christmas gifts, don't forget that the greatest gift ever given to man was not given in a box, but rather in the form of a human baby to reveal to us perfectly who God is, what he's like, what he expects of us, and what he offers us. He came to relate authentically to us, that he would know our struggles, that he would know our temptations and our trials and our difficulties and our hardships, that he would be able to say, I feel your pain. I've walked in your shoes. Come and receive grace and mercy. And he came to reconcile effectually, to restore friendly relations between you and God. All of man's attempts to be good are ineffectual attempts to be reconciled. Take the gift. Put your trust in this baby who grew into the man Jesus, who knew no sin, but became your sin so that in him you might become the righteousness of God. Now that's a Christmas gift that is outside the box. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for Jesus. Thank you for sending your own son as a human baby, vulnerable, dependent. I pray, Father, that you would help us to receive the gift. Gift of salvation. I pray, Father, you be glorified through us this Christmas season. Lord, as we look at this gift, as we explore this gift that you gave us in your abundant generosity, thank you for Jesus. In his name I pray.